Please turn to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23. It is only one verse that we will consider this morning as we continue to make our way through this most glorious chapter, this catalog of the Old Testament faithful. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. It's short enough to read it again, so let's do it again. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. I'd like to begin with a simple question, a question that you may well not anticipate. Have you ever tried to hide a baby? How do you do that? How do you hide a baby from being seen? Hide a baby from being smelled? Hide a baby from being heard? And how do you talk sense into a baby, as in, please don't cry, not now? We are told here that Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, hid Moses for what must have been the longest 3 months of their lives. Now, the Israelites had been in Egypt for about 350 years, and times had definitely changed for them. As one Pharaoh succeeded another, and another, and another, and so on, eventually, a king took the throne of Egypt for whom the name of Joseph meant nothing. All he could see was how the Israelites prospered in Egypt, and he felt threatened. So he signed an edict according to which all male babies, all Hebrew male babies, should be slaughtered at birth. To demoralize the nation and to curb their growth. Meanwhile, every Hebrew man served as a slave, consigned to slave labor in the mud pits and the construction sites of Egypt. So it was during this time of the world's first systematic, organized government persecution of God's people that Amram's and Jochebed's third child was born, Moses. His mother must have been petrified to hear the words, "It's a boy!" For how could she give up this baby? How could she obey a command so evil, so contrary to God's design? No, for the sacredness of human life itself, the parents could not obey the death warrant of the king. And yes, all believers, no matter where or when we live, all believers should be subject to their local and political authorities. But when they command what God forbids, or forbid what God commands, we have no choice, but we must obey God rather than men. But our text indicates a more specific insight on the parents' part. We read, they saw that the child was beautiful. And this is a commentary on Exodus 2:2, where the narrator, presumably Moses too, where the narrator writes that the mother saw the child, that it was good. Well, what does this mean? Does it mean that if this had been an ugly baby, the mother would have said, "Well, let's chuck him, ain't worth keeping"? Well, what did they see in their child? You won't be surprised to learn that Jewish literature speculates a great deal about this mysterious word. And Josephus, for example, in Antiquities Book 2, claims that Moses was, quote, exceedingly large and beautiful, for God had taken such great care in the formation of Moses that he caused him to be thought worthy of bringing up and saving. Similarly, the first century Jewish philosopher, Philo, or Philo as you would say, writes in the Life of Moses, book 1, that, quote, "As soon as Moses was born, he displayed a more beautiful and noble form than usual human creatures." Josephus goes even further, speculating that Amram had seen a vision from God, informing him about God's plan for this little baby, that he should be his prophet and the leader of God's people in the Exodus. Well, by comparison, the comment of Hebrews 11:23 is rather sparse, isn't it? And all it says is that they saw that the child was beautiful. But all things considered, it's quite possible that they saw more than a fine baby, but that his distinguished appearance also betokened some role for him to play in the plan of God. And let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's review what his parents did know. Amram and Jochebed did know the promises of the fathers. They did know that there would be an exodus, that after, roughly speaking, 400 years, Israel would be led out of Egypt and into the promised land. They knew these things. They also knew that the time had drawn near. All they needed to do was do the math. And they knew the time had come. And it is interesting that according to Acts chapter 7, verse 20, recording the speech of Stephen prior to his being stoned to death, the same attribute is assigned to this baby, except that here, Stephen says, Moses was not beautiful to his parents. He says he was beautiful in God's sight. In God's sight. Now let me ask you, when a person is beautiful in God's sight, is that a statement about the appearance or the physical features of a person? Or does God not look at the heart? And more than that, does God not see what that person will be or what that person will do? And no doubt it is the latter. When God found Moses to be beautiful in his sight, he saw that he would be his prophet. He would be the man who would lead Israel out of Egypt. He would accomplish his purpose through Moses. That's why he was beautiful in God's sight. And perhaps his parents had similar thoughts because God made them see more than an ordinary baby in Moses. This is not too far-fetched. I know it may sound wild, but it isn't too far-fetched. Because the idea draws support from the fact that, and this is the crux, this is the reason why you are here this morning, this is the reason why I preach this sermon. It was by faith. You heard this. It was by faith that they decided to hide the baby. Now, in all the instances where this phrase, by faith, occurred in Hebrews 11, and you've seen quite a few of them, what did we learn? In all the instances where this phrase is used in Hebrews 11, it never means a gut feeling. It never means a hunch. It never means voices in your head. It never means an emotional high. By faith describes no mere experience, but faith that responds to and attaches itself to God's revealed will. That's faith, according to Hebrews 11. And particularly, God's promise. As we said on previous occasions, faith is a reflex to revelation. Faith attaches itself to revelation, the revealed will of God. And it is in this sense that the hiding of Moses must be seen. It is in this sense that we must read the statement, they saw that the child was beautiful and that's why they did what they did. So let me put this together for you and say, the parents hoped in the future Exodus, they did. The parents knew the time was drawing near, they did. And because of all this, the promise of God that they really believed in, at the very least, they wanted their child to participate in it. So when they laid eyes on this beautiful little baby, they said, I don't want this baby to perish. I want him to have a part in the Exodus that God has promised, and possibly even more. You see, and so they risked their lives to save him. Now, can you imagine what these 3 months would have been like? 3 months, not 3 weeks, not 3 days, 3 months. Every time someone knocked on the door, their hearts would drop to the bottom of their boots. For surely the Egyptians enforced the edict of the king through random searches of homes. And it stands to reason that Amram and Jochebed were not the only ones who disobeyed the king's orders, who were trying to save their children. Or when Amram returned from his shift in the mud pits, his friends could never come home with him for a cup of tea like they used to, even if they invited themselves. Or their neighbors, who couldn't help but say to themselves, Jochebed, she hasn't been around lately. What's wrong with her? Is she sick? What would they tell them? And then, of course, at any time of the day, but particularly at night, they couldn't let the baby cry. When hungry or when the diaper was full, they couldn't let the baby cry. Shh, please don't cry. Not now, please don't. As I said, these must have been the longest 3 months of their lives. But they did this, we are told, because they were not afraid. Not afraid. Now, I believe they were afraid. I believe it is entirely unreasonable. I think it would be foolish to think that during these 3 months, they never experienced even a trace of fear. They were afraid. But what the author intends to say to you is that they didn't allow the fear of man to rule them, to shape their behavior, to govern them. Faith overcomes fear. That's the motto of this verse, of this text, of this story. Faith overcomes fear. And how appropriate, after all that we have learned about the Hebrews, this original audience, the addressees of this letter, how appropriate? Well, they had been through a lot. They had been beaten up, some of them imprisoned. Some of them had their property plundered by people because they could. They were Christians. After all, no one looked out after them. And they were afraid. Of course they were. They were afraid for themselves and they were afraid for their children. And because of their past experiences, there were people in that congregation who were teetering on the brink of apostasy. And because the author knew that this would have irremediable, eternal consequences, they needed a reminder of what faith does in the face of opposition and danger. Story turns on the idea. What does faith do in the face of danger and opposition? It's a necessary reminder for us too. You know this, because faith isn't something that we must learn. I should have said, and this is what I meant to say, fear. Fear isn't something that we must learn. Fear isn't something that we acquire by training. Fear in this world is a universal problem. I don't know whether you have thought about this lately, but to a large part, the behavior of people, the world is driven by fear. Various kinds of fears, to be sure. All kinds of fears. The devil uses fear as a weapon, as did Pharaoh of Egypt, to neutralize us as witnesses of the gospel. And don't think that fear is simply a problem for the shy and the mousy folks. Fear is a universal problem. Isn't the angry person or the one who aims at intimidating people, is that person not also determined by other people? Is that person not also afraid? As a matter of fact, any form of one-upmanship could qualify. But I'd like to change to a wide-angle lens, a wide-angle focus for a moment, and then return to the concept of fear and see the parents' faith in the context of the history of redemption, the whole story that God is telling in the Bible. Their faith, the implications of their faith overcoming fear are nothing short of panoramic. Consider, they didn't only save a baby, but without Moses, there would have been no Exodus. Yes, I speak from a human vantage point, and I do not intend to discount God's sovereign power by which he can do anything he wants to. But you know as well as I do that God's plan was fixed on this child, on Moses. And to save Moses was to save the Exodus. And every subsequent fulfillment of God's promises in the history of redemption. Consider that the parents' faith overcoming fear saved the man, the person, who would write the first five books of the Bible. First of all, the first five books of the Old Testament, and I do not need to tell you that these five books are foundational for the entire theology of the Old Testament. They're the bedrock. But not only for the Old Testament, for us folks who live in the 21st century AD, 3,500 years after Moses, these first five books of the Bible, they're still the introduction to the entire canon, and they shape the way that we think about each and every word in that book. Consider further that by putting their lives on the line, they saved the prophet. Prophet, without whom there would have been no subsequent prophets in Israel, for according to God's own testimony in Numbers 12, they all took their cue from Moses. He was the model that God set up, Moses. And in God's wise providence, I am even entitled to say that without Moses, there would be no Jesus. As a matter of fact, this story of the birth of Moses foreshadows the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem of Judah. There was another king who set his heart on infanticide, insane Herod the Great. And he wanted this child, Jesus, dead and buried more than anything else because he was motivated by the same powerful emotion as was Pharaoh. He was afraid of losing his power. And so, Joseph and Mary and the little baby Jesus, they had to flee to Egypt. Egypt of all places. The place where Moses was once hidden from the authorities. The place from which Moses took the children of Israel out. The place from which Jesus himself came out to re-enter the promised land. And when Herod didn't succeed, when he saw that he wouldn't succeed, he did what Pharaoh did. He stepped up his efforts. And he put all of the infants of Bethlehem, Judah, under the age of two, to the sword, a genuine bloodbath. Now, Jesus, Joseph, and Mary lived dangerously, as did Amram and Jochebed and Moses. But, brothers and sisters, such is the history of God's people. Even to this day, you know that for many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, it is an everyday experience to live in danger. Not in danger of being hit by a car or crashing with an airplane, but in danger because you're a Christian, because you stand for Jesus Christ. It's dangerous in many parts of the world. And that's not a surprise. Jesus has always told us about this beforehand. It's the history of the church. And the history of the church is a history of sin, failure, corruption. But we do not want to forget that the history of the church is also a history of challenges overcome and fear overcome by faith in the promise of God. And the chief example to follow is Jesus. Now, if this text has anything for you as a Christian, it would have to be this. It is this: faith. Our faith must do the same thing. It must overcome the fear of man because we fear God more. And the chief example is Jesus himself, who on the eve of his crucifixion said to his disciples, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death." And what he had in mind was more than what people would do to him the next day, although it was included. And then he fell on his face and he prayed, "My Father, if it be possible, then let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." I see faith overcoming fear in Jesus as well. And why didn't God intervene? Why didn't he, as Jesus once suggested himself, why didn't he send 12 legions of angels or more and level the place, quiet the people, take them out? He could not. He couldn't. It was his decree that his son should suffer for your sins. But we could ask the same question, couldn't we? Why does God not take you out of your trials? Why doesn't he make your life a little easier? Why does he not protect you from all danger, difficulties, or reproach? He wants to deepen the exercise of your faith. And like it or not, this book tells it. It tells you that his curriculum always includes faith overcoming fear. If what 1 John 5:4 says about faith, that faith, it is our faith that overcomes the world, then it certainly also means that our faith must overcome fear, because fear is rampant in the world and characterizes the world to a great deal. It is because of fear that there are wars. It is because of fear that people steal. It's because of fear that people lie. It's because of fear that people kill each other.